We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon about emotions and values with a psychologist and a pastoral counselor and Christian minister, Jack Good, by phone from Roanoke, Virginia. Welcome, Jack.
Always good to be with you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So we have a good phone connection, I'm glad, because we're experiencing some rather difficult weather here in Illinois. So how are things in Roanoke?
They're much more pleasant than that, but I hope the storms keep people at home where they're listening to the radio.
Well, we hope to be able to stay on the air.
Yes, well, that's important, too.
You have a new book out, just out this year, Emotions and Values, Exploring the Source of Jesus' Strength and Influence. You have other books that you've published, and I'll be mentioning those in a minute because I think they're relevant to this discussion we're going to have today. But before we get into the discussion of your book, one of the emotions that you talk about in your book is grief. And those of us, and many of us here in Champaign-Urbana, have been experiencing that emotion with the death of Don Mason, the pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Urbana, who died a couple weeks ago. I was traveling when I heard the news. In fact, I was in North Carolina, and my wife and I were planning that evening to see Don's daughter, Marita, and her husband and their new baby. And we all got the news that day, and so we were not able to meet because they were flying, of course, immediately to New Mexico to be with her, with Marita's mother. But Don had been a guest on this program just July 12th, and we had interviewed him as he was talking about the Church Conference Center, Ghost Ranch, there in New Mexico, where he and his wife were volunteers for 7 months over this summer, where unfortunately he had a hiking accident and was killed. I'd like to ask you a little bit about grief, but before that, I'd like to impose on our listeners just another moment and share a poem that I wrote as part of my grief response to losing a friend. This is a very short poem. It's only eight lines, and the form comes partly influenced by acrostic psalms in the Bible. An acrostic, of course, uses letters, perhaps in alphabetical order, but in this case, spelling out the name Don Mason along the left side of the column. And the poem as it came out says this: Donna and you often drove down old and narrow country roads, but new to you, a fresh, bright trail found. Many faith paths shared, searched, and sought Africa and New Mexico. Serving all, trusting to a fault, open, caring, building shallow new wells in jungle and desert. A poem I wrote after hearing of the death of Don Mason.
That's very touching, Steve, and it's a good example of expressing grief and letting that be open and very public.
The reference to shallow wells was because one of Don and Donna's concerns was using some money from this country, from the Urbana Rotary Club, from First Presbyterian Church here in Urbana, and from others to help build wells, providing very needed water to villages in Malawi, where they had actually hoped to retire, to spend a bit of volunteer time, maybe a year of volunteering, and that didn't work out, and then they ended up in New Mexico, and then this tragedy happened. I might mention that if people would like to listen to Don talking about that beautiful setting in New Mexico, where he chose to have, he had chosen in advance to have his ashes buried there. If you'd like to listen to that program, it is archived and available online. So by your computer, you can go to will.illinois.edu, and you'll get the choice of AM, FM, or TV, and go to AM, and then go to Keeping the Faith, and you'll see various programs. And again, that was broadcast July 12th and is available on the archive program. It's very poignant to hear Don speaking about that beautiful place that he loves so much. Tell us a little bit about why you're interested in emotions as a theologian.
I had two conversion experiences. People of my theological bent don't say much about conversions, but I actually had two very close together. I grew up with the standard belief that if you really want to be in control of your life and go directly towards your goals, you will be an intellectual person and operate out of your mind. And there was a negative implication of the word emotion. Emotional people were to be avoided. You know, they were to be kept in check. They can do all manner of damage. And two things happened to me when I was pastoring a church in upstate New York. I was also being a therapist at a counseling center. And one young couple came to see me, and it was obvious from the first few sessions that they had turned all their emotions off because they had had a bad experience trying to relate to each other emotionally. And so they tried to keep loving each other, but they would not experience anger or grief or fear. And the fact was that their emotions, their marriage was falling apart. It occurred to me that maybe I needed to rethink the idea that emotions were always an evil and intellect was always good, because simply relating to each other intellectually was not working for them. But of course, an outgrowth of my view that that mental activity was good and emotions were bad was the assumption that Jesus, this most influential person perhaps who ever lived, was entirely intellectual, had no emotions to drive him to do the kinds of things that emotions drive the rest of us to do. And
that he wasn't really human somehow.
That he did not have that aspect of humanity about him.
Right.
And one day, in trying to keep my Greek, very limited Greek skills alive, I was reading in the Gospel of Mark, I think it's the third chapter, where someone brought a person with a withered hand to him, and it was the Sabbath. And others standing around said, "You can't heal his hand because you cannot work on the Sabbath." And Jesus, according to the translation we're mostly familiar with, turned to him and turned to them in anger, grieved at their hardness of heart. But in the Greek, those words are much more powerful. The word for anger is orgos, which comes into English with sexual orientation.
Orgasm, sure.
Yeah, and every other place that's used in the New Testament where it doesn't refer to Jesus, it's translated wrath. And so it occurred to me that Jesus was not just experiencing a little righteous indignation there, but he was boiling mad, and that opened the possibility that perhaps all of us could be blood-boiling mad sometimes in the service of our values. So those two things together made me reconsider what is the role of emotions in building the life of faithfulness. And as I began to examine more about Jesus, I became fascinated with this, and I read through the gospel stories with a sheet of paper in front of me, noting the times when indicated that Jesus was either teaching about one of the emotions or experiencing one of the emotions, and that list became very long. And it was out of that fascination with that and the experience of a couple who tried to be intellectual and found they could not seize control of their lives that way that led me to what has been years of study of the relationship between emotions and values.
I want to talk in more detail about all that, of course, but let me just take a moment to share something with listeners. Our guest today, Jack Good, and I have been friends for a long time. And in fact, in this particular book of his that's just out this year, Emotions and Values, he even mentions me in his acknowledgments very kindly. And so I want to be honest about that, but also call on listeners' help, because I may not be asked as critical questions as perhaps I might if we didn't have this long-term friendship and if I had not read this book in an earlier form. And so I'm particularly eager today to have listeners call in. One of the advantages of a live call-in show is that the host's biases can be overcome with listeners' participation. So let me give the phone numbers right away. In Champaign-Urbana, where this program originates, listeners can punch in 333-9455. And if it's a long-distance call, if you're listening anywhere the program is heard, we're heard with at least good weather all the way from Chicago to Indianapolis, and of course, via the Internet, even farther away. So if it's a long-distance call, don't hesitate to use the 800 number, 800-222-9455. And again, our guest is Jack Good, and that's an easy name to remember, both for finding the book and also for calling in with a question or a comment. So since this is a topic that you don't have to have read the book to know a little bit about emotions, as listeners, please call with questions or comments. Jack, let's go immediately to the first sentence in your book, which is wonderful. We are what we love. Tell us about that.
Well, I see us as going through our lives with two structures that overlap, of course. One is our physical structure. I refer to it as our bone structure. That's a gift of our genes, but the other is a value structure that we build as we go through life, the things that we let into our lives by loving them. And we defend that value structure with anger and fear. We strengthen it by joy. We change it by grief. All the emotions play some role in keeping and strengthening that value structure. And it's a combination of the two structures that make human life human. So I am what I love. I'm also my bones and muscle and the rest of me physically. But I'm also and equally a product of a value structure that I choose. And I make the argument that at the end of life, as people write our obituaries, they always mentioned what we have loved and the values that we have embraced, the causes that have motivated us. And very few of them ever say anything about our physical structure, whether you had high cheekbones or weighed more than you should or any of those things. They are forgotten as people summarize their lives. So over the long run, seeing it in the totality of a life, I am convinced that the value structures that we construct ourselves and that we defend emotionally become more important than the genetic structure of our bodies. So this is why I can say we are what we love. We become that as we pass through a life. Two people who love each other in marriage, for instance, can influence each other to the extent that one wise person said, we call each other into being by our love. And I think Jesus calls many of us into being by the way that he practiced an elaborate form of love.
You point out in your first couple chapters that falling in love is what people often think about when they hear the word love, but that's the type of love that you find perhaps most important is a different kind of love, a love that is the type that Jesus commands his followers to do, which
yes.
seems very different.
Yes, exactly. We talk about love as if it's something we fall into, as if we'd slipped on a banana peel or something. And there's a great deal of love that goes that way. I mentioned that my wife and I found ourselves in love, much to our own surprise. But as any marriage that's lasted as long as ours has, there are times when the strength of that falling in love wanes, and if we are to remain together, we practice what I call chosen love. Others have called it that too. We choose to be loving to each other and to perform the loving acts that go to that, even when the emotion or the strength of the emotion itself is has waned to some degree. And so it's a really strong love is a combination of the two. It, for people who are in love, that's mixture of the erotic plus the fact that they choose to love. When Paul describes love in the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, he says nothing about falling in love. He describes what it is, what the acts of love are. Love is patient, love is kind, and so forth. So I insist that that we can choose to love, and that Jesus was right when he insisted that we love even our enemies, which is a tough thing, and I spend some time on that. But it can be done, and there are many people, such as the Amish in Pennsylvania whose children were shot, who determined that they would forgive and include the family of the man who had shot their children in the gifts that came to them.
And you also mention as an example of that some of the relatives and friends of victims of the 9/11 terrorist attacks who formed a group to try to bring peace and not respond in anger even to that.
Absolutely, and they're traveling through the country speaking to people, trying to build more respect for the Islamic faith and more respect for people who are different, insisting that we not respond or with evil to the evil that was done to us.
I particularly appreciated on rereading this book in preparation for our talk today, the sections that you did on anger and fear. People often, get kind of, when they hear the word love, they think, oh, well, that's an interesting ideal. But many people feel somehow that anger is inappropriate if you're a loving person. But you talk very realistically about anger. Share some of that.
Well, I see anger as actually a moral emotion.
An appropriate response.
Yes.
Often.
If things are going badly for the values that you choose, for instance, those people that you just mentioned whose loved ones were lost in 9/11, their values reach out to a world in which people love and accept each other. And so they have turned their anger into an effort to build that kind of world. Anger can do some very bad things, and I spend a great deal of time in the book spelling out some of the things that anger can do to us if we leave it uncontrolled. But anger, when disciplined and channeled, can also be an anger that says, when the bad things I value are being destroyed, it's time to be angry and to do something about that and to channel that anger into defending those values. And this, I think, is the real role of anger in life.
And you give an example of Jesus, or several examples, actually, of Jesus being angry and having that described in the Gospels as an appropriate response to certain situations.
Yes, we've already mentioned one of those when people brought in a person with a withered hand for healing on the Sabbath, and he turned to them with wrath. And, of course, we know the wrath that he sometimes used to speak to people of his own religious community who would turn too much towards legalism, and he could be very scathing in his comments about that. He used words, not fists or swords, to accomplish his deeds. And, of course, there is a famous incident of his cleansing the temple, and we don't really know precisely what happened because there are four different accounts of that in the Gospels, each with a different set of details. But it was clear that he was angry, and it was clear that he was doing something about that, and no indication that any blood was spilled. But we do need to channel our anger for the things that we value. And one of the things that grows out of that, by the way, is that when we become angry and we're not quite sure what that was about, it really helps to step back from that at times and ask ourselves, what is it that I value that was under attack when I found myself getting that angry? And is that something I really want in my value system? So it serves at least that second purpose, too.
We're talking with Jack Good today by phone from his home in Roanoke, Virginia, where he and his wife Diana have retired after a ministry that included Champaign-Urbana as pastor of the Community United Church of Christ here. And pastor, it's elsewhere. You mentioned upstate New York, Jack. Where else have you been a pastor?
Well, I spent 17 years in upstate New York and 15 years in Champaign-Urbana, which I treasure the memory of that. And then I served a couple of churches in Virginia. And I've also served student pastorates in Massachusetts and in New York, Syracuse.
And you've had international experience. You might mention that.
Yes, through a 4-H program of cultural exchange, I went to Pakistan. And this will really date me, went back when Pakistan was both what we call Pakistan today and included Bangladesh. So I had an experience of living with the people in the villages, both in Pakistan and what is now Bangladesh. One is a kind of Western culture, very much a Western culture, Pakistan, but Bangladesh is very much an Eastern culture. So I treasure the memory of that experience also. It also showed me, by the way, many of the better sides of people who are poor and Islamic people who can be so generous in their hospitality. It was a wonderful experience.
Your book refers to Jesus in the subtitle, Emotions and Values, Exploring the Source of Jesus' Strength and Influence. But I was noticing again how open you are to insights, wisdom from other religious traditions, not only Islam, but also Buddhist and Jewish in this book. How do you reconcile the differences between the various religious faiths personally? How do you, as a Christian pastor, think about the relation between faiths?
I see, as an organization I belong to puts it, that Jesus is the door that opens to admit me into the divine realm. That does mean that in other traditions there might not be other doors that admit people into the divine realm. And I see that as enriching religion rather than limiting it. And I think that what Jesus was doing, and I insist here that Jesus was actually being the next step in a kind of evolution to make us more fully human. We're still in the process of becoming human. That what he was doing is not limited to his own followers, but is open to people of all persuasions. Gandhi, for instance, I think was a person who embraced the Sermon on the Mount, as he's been famously quoted as doing, and in that regard chose the same values of Jesus and lived them out passionately. And so I have no hesitation in embracing him as a part of my religious, spiritual tradition.
I see we have a couple people on the phone waiting. Let's go to line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
I heard your comments and the comments of your guest, and I was surprised that he thought that Jesus was not emotional. it seems to me the New Testament is quite evident about that. For example, when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, it says in Matthew 26, relating that experience, and he cometh unto the disciples and findeth them asleep, and says unto Peter, what could you not watch with me 1 hour? In other words, he is disappointed. And he also, you talked about anger. Disappointment seems to be an issue. And another time, he looks at a city and feels that the people not obeying the commandments of the Lord are to be, well, I don't know, pity is maybe not the word, but he says he was saddened by this kind of thing. He was not angry. He was saddened that they wouldn't pay attention. Is that not a reasonable way of reading it?
Absolutely, and you're an insightful person, and you apparently got to those insights before I did. I, as I said, grew up with the assumption that Jesus was non-emotional, and it's possible just to read those stories and to gloss over what the implications are until I really sensitized myself to it. And the incidents that you describe, I also describe in the book.
Okay. I don't know the book, sorry.
What's that?
I say I don't know the book in detail. I only heard what you said on the program.
Yes, but I'm saying that that the insights that you have had were similar to mine. I would add that when Jesus was almost to be crucified the night before that, he experienced fear at a very deep level, and fear that was so great that the writer said that his sweat of his brow turned to blood, and we've incorporated that into our language. When we're terribly afraid, we're saying, we often say of ourselves, we sweat blood.
Okay, well, let me say one other thing. I don't know exactly where that is at the moment, but there is a scripture in the New Testament that says, for Jesus so loved the world, and I mean, for God so loved the world that he gave his own daily begotten son, and so on. So there is love also attributed, and, you know, anyway, I don't want to contradict you. I was very, very surprised that somebody would assume that there would be no emotion in the Lord.
Yes, well, I'm afraid I have a lot of company there, and this is one reason I wrote the book.
Okay.
You mentioned one other thing I want to comment on. You mentioned that God loves the world. And if we are what we love, then if God loves the world, God has absorbed the world into God's self. Mm-hmm. And when we love God, we absorb God into ourselves. Okay. So that's a very profound passage there.
I happen to be of a church that is not yours, and so I sometimes look at these things a little differently. But at any rate, this business about God being the world and we becoming part of God by loving him is something that I respect in your belief, but I'm not sure that I share that. But I don't want to go into an argument about that. I simply
it's perfectly okay not to agree. I'm just trying to get
the
session started. And so you're very insightful, and I appreciate your call.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for the call. Jack, when you were talking about your earliest experiences growing up, feeling that Jesus was somehow only rational and not emotional, in this book you describe how you later learned how that in many of those passages, some of which we've already talked about in the Gospels, Jesus clearly was very emotional, and in fact, most of your book is describing those emotions of Jesus that he did experience, and with your further study, and you learned things that were very helpful, you think, to those who would follow Jesus. We have several other callers waiting. Let's go to line number two. Yes, you're on the air. Line number two.
Yes, it's nice to hear from you again, Jack. I think as we read the Bible, it's sometimes harder to imagine that Jesus had positive emotions, that he was happy, or that he had a sense of humor. Have you dealt with that at all in your book?
Absolutely. I have a whole chapter on Jesus and joy. And I guess as I wrote it, it was the easiest to write and the most fun to write. I guess that makes sense. The word joy appears in the Gospels. I've forgotten the exact number. I think it's about 23 times. And the coming of Jesus was announced as an occasion for joy to all mankind, all humankind. And then he did such things as attend a Jewish wedding. Jewish weddings were events that went on for 3 days of celebration, dancing, singing. And Jesus was invited to that. You don't invite killjoys to your 3-day wedding celebration. And Jesus was accepted by children. Children are kind of barometers to adult personalities, and they tend to avoid people who are joyless. And so there are many indirect implications of the fact, or indications of the fact, that Jesus really was a person of joy and laughter. And he told some funny stories. I can't recite all those now for a lack of time. But he told some very funny stories, most of which we miss because we put on our long face when we turn to the scripture, and we think it's all so sacred that we can't smile or even laugh a bit. You referred to joy and love.
Being happy and joyful,
Yes, being happy and joyful, and I think Jesus was a person who radiated joy and happiness. And what grows out of that for me is that when we are committed to some sense of values, that we need to accept those things joyfully. And if there are people who share your views on world peace, for instance, and you get together with those from time to time, part of that ought to be time when you simply have a party and laugh together. It builds fellowship and it builds strength within yourself. So this is a very important part of it.
We have another caller again, on this time on Local Line 1. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Well, thank you for this interesting program. I years ago understood that in the English Bible, the term love had its origin in at least 3 different Greek words. And so you had eros and philia and agape, and I have no idea how many Aramaic words apply to the term love, and the Hebrew Bible, or a Hebrew version of the Old Testament, and Hebrew use of the word love, I don't have the slightest idea, but In my theological experience, it was basically the Greek. We don't seem to give credit to the breadth of love, and you sort of touched it early on. Do you have some elaboration in that respect in your book?
I did not go into the uses of the Greek words, and that would have been an interesting but would have taken several additional pages. Most of the references to love that I use in there are agape love, and the others that you mentioned have to do with brotherly love and friendship love. But Jesus, when he demanded that we love our neighbor, was talking about agape, which makes it an especially difficult thing to do. And
because yes, it's a self-giving love.
Yes, it's a total self-giving love, which does not consider the self, but considers the other person and the humanity of the other person. And when Paul is speaking of the 13th chapter of Corinthians I mentioned before, where he says love is patient and kind, all of that is agape love. I do speak in the book of the varieties of love. We've talked already about erotic love and chosen love. But there's also a strange way in which love, when it sours, goes bad, becomes hate, and is still an emotion of attachment, but it's attachment gone bad. And I spend several paragraphs discussing that. I am convinced that even all those things relate to a person's sense of values, often seen in a couple who are divorced and still trying to battle out things of the past. They hate each other, but they can't turn loose of each other, so it's still attachment. That's not love, but it's love gone sour. So there are many aspects and dimensions of love, as you indicate, and I try to touch on some of them. I doubt very seriously if I got all of them. I doubt that very seriously. But I tried to paint the fact that, as you indicate, that it's not a simple matter. Love also can be destructive, by the way, and Jesus mentioned that when he said he came not to bring peace but a sword, and then he describes some of the neurotic relationships that can grow up within families and said that his sword was used to break those neurotic relationships. So love can even turn neurotic. But ordinarily it is the force that brings separated individuals together and is the thing we strive for, and what Jesus, I think, was asking us to do when he said, follow me.
We're a bit past halfway for our program today with Jack Good talking about his new book, Emotions and Values, exploring the source of Jesus' strength and influence, where he talks about the emotions of Jesus as seen in the Bible. Jack has published previous books that deal with the Bible, one that was has become very widely used, called The Dishonest Church, and before that, The Bible Faith's Family Album. And I want to talk a little bit about those in just a moment. Support for Keeping the Faith is provided in part by the University YMCA at the University of Illinois. It is the oldest religious affiliated organization at the university. It's been around 135 years now. Well, let's get back to our guest. And Jack, I was having a brunch this morning with some scientists here at the university. A young man had just gotten his PhD, and I was invited because of my wife's being a microbiologist here and researcher. And often on these occasions, you know, the one minister who's there gets asked questions about the Bible. And so one of the questions was, where did the wives come from for Cain and Abel? And another question was, what happened to all the freshwater fish when the flood, you know, covered the whole earth and things like that? Now, one of your earlier books dealt with that, The Bible Faith's Family Album. How would you have responded?
Well, I have some problems with people who try to take all of that with utmost literacy, literary truthfulness, that it's literal truth. It is not written to be literal at all. It was written to be, and I hesitate to use the word myth because it has baggage that makes people think we're saying it isn't true. I like to refer to those stories as truth stories, in quotes. Stories that contain truth, as a container contains water, for instance. And the truth and the water is not to be confused with the container, but can be poured from one generation to the next containers all along the way. For instance, the freshwater fish. What worries me about that story is what happened to the two rabbits when there were lions on board. What did the lions eat and so forth? So obviously that was not intended to be a literal truth story, but is a story about how if humanity forgets that it's human and begins to treat itself, the world, and other living beings inhumanely, that there can be some very bad results to that. And the Bible is very open about the fact that we cause many of the problems that that befall us. And maybe global warming is another kind of flood that is coming upon us because we have misused the planet. So anyway, it's a matter of seeing that as a metaphor for our times, as a myth. I use that word as describing the deepest truth that we can have. Or again, I like the phrase a truth story. So it's not literal, but it's always, usually at least, pointing to something that is very deep and very real.
And the Cain and Abel story certainly shows how even in families there can be very destructive emotions that can lead to violence and death.
Yeah, to put the two books together, anger in this case was used very destructively, as it often is. And I try to insist on in this latest book that anger can produce many results. Violence is only one of those, so we need, when we're angry, to ask ourselves, what do we want to do with this? hopefully we want to do something that is constructive and protective of values and not to kill our brothers with it.
I want to get back to those emotions in a moment, but let me just mention another of your books that was read very widely and used in many congregations, not only Christian but otherwise, The Dishonest Church, where you point out that in many education of religious leaders, they learn the various forms that the Bible was written in, for example, and it's many of those forms were not specifically history. They were, as you say, sagas, legends to tell important truths, but not to try to be scientific, for example. But that often that teaching that's given to religious leaders isn't passed on to people in the pews, and all they hear is the story.
Yes, exactly. That there's that great separation between what religious professionals are taught in seminary and what they feel they can share in their pulpits, and I insist that they could share a great deal more of that if they would do it in loving ways that accept people's religious background without judging it, but indicate that there's room for growth. All those professionals went through and had their religion challenged and rebuilt, and the people in the pews need to be respected enough to know that they too could go through some alteration in their beliefs. For instance, in seminary we learned a great deal about the way the major creeds were put together and the fact that the Nicene Creed was not just written on the spot, but it went through 75 years of adjustments and unfortunately some violence until the final form of it was hammered out. And the same is true of many passages in the Bible that were the result of several editors. And I refer in there to some of the arguments that are taking place in the scriptures that people in pulpits feel they can't deal with, but people are being shortchanged when that takes place, and they're not being respected as being people who can deal with anything other than what they've already been taught. So I felt very strongly about that, and the book didn't get a good reception.
We have another caller waiting. Others may join the conversation, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. Line number one, you're on Keeping the Faith. Yes.
I have two quick comments, and I'll hang up and listen.
Sure.
One is that Jesus experienced grief when Lazarus died, and the people even remarked about it and said, "Behold how he loved him." And the other one is in one of the letters from Paul, I don't know which one, it says, be angry, but do not sin. So I thought that meant, well, be angry, but just don't use it badly. And I'll hang up now. Thank you.
Thanks.
Oh, very good. Both insightful. yes. Referring to the first one, Jesus did experience grief, and that's a kind of strange story told by John. Jesus goes to the home of a friend who has died, and he comforts the women, their members of the family. And he himself cries, and then in a few minutes raises Lazarus from the dead. And one wonders if Jesus knew that he was going to raise Lazarus, why he was so sad about all that. So there's a great deal of strange information there. I think what the writer was trying to convey to us is that Jesus was a human being who experienced loss as we do, and as Steve was reporting in the loss of his friend, our friend Don Mason, it was very deep and very profound, and then the resurrection of Lazarus was, I think, a later addition put in to prepare readers for the resurrection of Jesus. But yes, Jesus did grieve, and that's one of the things that I want to did stress in the book, that he grieved just as the rest of us do, and perhaps at a deeper level. And then the phrase that you referred to, be angry but don't sin, That's a great summary of what I tried to say in the book, or the chapter on anger, that anger can lead either to Cain and Abel attacking each other and one being killed, or it can lead to resolution of something that is really bothering two people and needs to be resolved, that two people feel strongly enough about to feel angry, but if they can resolve it with words instead of guns and fists, will lead to something constructive. So yes, do be angry. That's the point. Don't just repress anger and identify it as sinful and avoid it, but don't use it in inappropriate and destructive ways. So that's a good text.
Jack, about halfway through your book, you start using the example of the couple that came to you for counseling, who you said had been, it became clear to you after two or three sessions of counseling, that they really had decided early on in their relationship to repress negative emotions, somehow feeling that perhaps the relationship wouldn't be able to withstand it. But as a result, things had gotten worse. Tell us about what steps they needed to go through to get to a better place in their relationship.
Yeah, that's a very interesting story, and I've changed enough details so that I protected the privacy of this couple. But they had come in relating the fact that they had gone into their first argument as a married couple, and he related to her in the way that his father had related to his mother, which was to withdraw and let the emotions cool, and she related to him the way her parents had, which was to stand there and fight it out verbally until they hadn't reached some conclusion and then kiss and make up. And so when he turned and left her, she was just devastated, and they never did find a way to solve the problem that had led to all this, but they did make a kind of unconscious decision that they're going to relate without anger, try not to be afraid of each other, just relate as if they were mind to mind, computer to computer. And as you indicate, it just wasn't working. Their marriage was breaking down. Their relationship to their friends were breaking down, and their lives were out of control. And this because they were trying to be intellectual, which I thought was the way to be in control, and it began to force me to reevaluate all that. And what they had to do, of course, is to reacquaint themselves with anger and grief and sadness. One of the things that happened as they began to heal was that they acknowledged how sad they were of what had happened to them. And they had to deal with their guilt. They had done a number of things to hurt each other. And one day in counseling, one of them acknowledged that they had done something that had hurt the other and was sorry about it and expected to be further berated because of that. And instead of that, the other person said, well, I've done a lot of bad things too. And that opened the doors to guilt, and they were able to heal. But then another and most interesting factor was that they were members of a small but dynamic church there in the community, where they thought they were hearing every Sunday that Jesus was this ideal person who never experienced emotions, or certainly not destructive emotions. And we had to go through a process, which I joined them in, of seeing that Jesus indeed experienced all of these emotions because he loved people and because he loved ideals and dreams. And so their transformation had to do with partly a religious understanding of Jesus as a man passionate about the things he believed in, and they became more passionate not only to each other but to the world at large. And I knew at that point that their marriage would survive, and it did.
Now, your training was in pastoral counseling after your regular theological training, and you mentioned that you found yourself in this position where there wasn't any other psychologist or psychiatrist in the whole county where you were, and so you were able to do this in addition to being a pastor. After that time in New York, did you continue to do as much counseling, or did the pressures of other pastoral duties make that less a part of your life?
Well, the burdens of doing both things in upstate New York was just about to to do me in.
So
when I was given a call to Champaign, I welcomed that because it would focus my attention primarily on being a pastor, and I did some additional long-term therapy, but it was much more limited. And, of course, you can do pastoral care in the sermon on Sunday morning. I've read your sermons, and I know you do that, and I try to do that. So it wasn't that I turned my back on the counseling, but that I tried to do it in other ways. You can also do counseling as you visit people, especially when they're in the last stages of an illness. So all those are ways in which my psychological training still served me well, but I did not do the extent of long-range therapy that I had in the past, and that was fine with me.
Now, you and your wife, Diana, after retirement, have been in Roanoke and establishing new friendships and relationships there with the congregation and so on. You mentioned in your book that that many people feel they can be spiritual without being in a community, and yet you feel somehow they're missing something important. Have you found that true in your own life?
Yes, very much so. I need a supportive community, and the particular community that we're a part of here are made up of other people who are free to think for themselves, and of course we don't always agree on everything. One person in the meeting that we attend calls himself a Buddhist, and others are more traditional Christians than I. But we support each other, we love each other, and my wife has been ill for some time, and they've been enormously helpful to us and caring. And even as I explore spirituality and ask basic questions, it really is so helpful to have other people who are open to that with whom to explore. And so these are fellow travelers. That's a bad phrase from the past, isn't it? But these are people who join me in the spiritual journey, and we don't judge each other, but we go together. I can hardly imagine doing that on your own without the care and support of other people. I know some people seem to feel that they're managing it, but for me, I need that support, that community.
We're out of time. We've been talking with Jack Good, a longtime friend of mine, who is the author of a brand-new book out just this year from St. Johann Press in New Jersey, Emotions and Values, Exploring the Source of Jesus' Strength and Influence. He's the author of several prior books, The Bible, Faith's Family Album, and another book called The Dishonest Church, also The Fortunate Ones, Beatitudes and Biographies. Appreciate, Jack, you talking with us by phone about your current book. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the host for Keeping the Faith today. Support for these programs is provided by the University Y, and I remind you, thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.